Mike.
Hey, Jamie from Georgia.
Hey, Mike from California.
How's it going?
It's going.
Jamie, I learned a new word this week.
What did you learn?
First of all, how are you, Jamie?
I'm doing great. Thank
Good.
You.
Good.
How are you, Mike?
I'm great. My new word is deuteragonist. You heard that before?
Nope.
Well, there's a protagonist, an antagonist, and a deuteragonist.
What?
The second most important character, usually a sidekick, is a deuteragonist.
Huh.
As in Jim to Huck Finn or Watson to Sherlock Holmes.
As in who?
Like Jim to Huck Finn.
I see.
Or Watson to Sherlock Holmes. Thank you for that appealing chime of assent when I said that.
That is very interesting.
It's like getting correct answer on Wheel of Fortune.
You're welcome.
You had some sort of chime go off. You're very musical, Jamie. You have all kinds of sound.
Well, I'm glad to know that you appreciate it.
You have all kinds of sound effects clinging and clanging as we podcast.
Yes.
And so in addition to all those words, Jamie, protagonist, antagonist, deuteragonist, there's a tritagonist, the third most important character.
Well, I'm starting to get an education from you.
Forget where I saw it, probably just reading through stuff. And then you see the word and you can now click, of course, on words in most word programs or whatever, tablets and stuff. You can click on the word and it gives you the definition.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool. So I got down a little rabbit hole there with my agonists.
Well, I think it's impressive, and I appreciate you for teaching me something.
And actually, I learned an antagonist can be something other than a person. And they gave examples of like Sauron, like it's the evil of the Lord of the Rings, or anyone not Holden in Catcher in the Rye was an antagonist. Anyone or anything in opposition to the protagonist can be the antagonist. All right, Jamie, I thought we might rank some, before we get into the details of this episode, which is 209 Nailed on West Coast Project for Better Call Saul, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we might go through a little discussion here. Let's rank some of these Better Call Saul mysteries. Let's not maybe rank them, but let's discuss them.
Okay.
And we may have talked about some of this before, but what do you think, in light of 209, what do you think is going to be Kim's exit? Because we don't see Kim in Breaking Bad.
Okay, so in light of 209, I think... Okay, well, all right. So I will say this. The new information that I have about Kim after this episode is that Kim is not terribly opposed to running a little scam herself. I mean, we know that about strangers, but what she did with Jimmy tonight and last night was kind of, I mean, it was really quick thinking on her feet. I mean, and she was a very good actress about, you know, what she did and the things that she said to Chuck. So I don't know if Kim doesn't have something to do with her own exit. And I think that maybe she either gets exhausted from Jimmy and having to clean up behind him, or that she gets herself into a little trouble.
Yeah, I think Kim's throwing down on Jimmy's side tonight clearly puts her in the danger zone.
Danger like...
Like death. Death, danger, perhaps... perhaps fraud, some sort of jail time. Something bad. Something other than which I thought all along was going to happen before tonight. She throws up her hands. Jimmy, this is enough, man. I love you, but I can't do this anymore with you. She throws down with him on his side tonight, even in light of his pretty serious fraud with what he did with Chuck's documents.
Yeah.
And I think that paints her into a pretty bleak future.
Maybe so. Maybe so.
I add that together with the fact that we've never seen her in Breaking Bad, so we don't know about her in the future, that maybe she's not around in the future.
Okay, so I don't count that so much because we could not have seen her in Breaking Bad because she didn't exist and neither did Better Call Saul, you know, as a series. So I don't count that so much. He didn't have a love interest.
He had, well, what's her name? The secretary.
That wasn't his love interest. He's just.
I know, I'm kidding.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't know. What do you think?
I just think it's something bad for her, and it's seriously bad. It's not just, hey, I'm going to do this on my own, Jimmy. I love you, but goodbye. I can't see you anymore. I think it's bad, bad stuff. How about a mystery which appears to be imminent, Gus's entrance?
All right, so... All right, I'm with you on the imminent part. I think that we might see Gus next week, or at least get an inkling that Gus is on the horizon. Click. When I think about the name of episode 10, the only thing that really comes to me is the thought of a weapon, a gun, maybe really close to somebody's body, maybe their head, you know, and then pulling back on the, what is that thing called?
Hammer.
Yeah.
Could it be the switch Jimmy flipped in the office, the switch to nowhere, makes that man may have made a click?
You are so smart.
It's also spelled with a K at the beginning, which makes it odd.
Yeah, which made me wonder what language they spell click with a K.
Yeah, I don't know.
Could be Russian. Could be Spanish. Let's see. I'll look it up while you talk to me.
And then just my third one, I put what's the mystery of Mike's plan? And I wrote these down before I saw this episode, so I thought now after having seen the episode, I kind of know Mike's plan. But maybe I could rephrase it into what happens with Mike's plan? Because he seems to have taken a couple half measures, and he's seen the results now, a pretty bad result from his last half measure, and it didn't work, and now he's got to deal with it. He's still kind of hidden from the Salamanca clan, except for Nacho knowing. But how does Mike's plan evolve into its next stage?
I don't know.
We know his plan was to get the Salamancas caught, to screw up their whole operation and get Hector in trouble and get kind of everybody, Tuco, everybody kind of in trouble by leaving the evidence laying around on the road.
Okay. I don't know. I think that a large part of what Mike did was just for the satisfaction of pissing off Hector, because he was sitting in his car looking into Hector's restaurant with his binoculars, and he saw Hector flip out and be so frustrated and take the pill. Mike got a little happy grin on his face. So I think part of it was just, I'm going to give you hell. Because you gave me hell. Oh, and by the way, Mike, I looked up click with a K, and I had Google detect the language, and the language it detected is German, and the translation is clicking.
Okay, clears that right up.
I'm just saying, clicking with a C, it translated from the K to a C, so maybe we have some bad guys who are German coming along.
Well, we have Ehrmantraut, and we have Schwartz, and we have Madrigal. Well, I don't know what else is German in the future that might be connected to something German in Better Call Saul.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, and Gus was, like, in tight with those German dudes.
Yeah, and that was also very mysteriously left undeveloped in Breaking Bad. I like how at least I entertain the idea that they may be clearing up some of these ideas that were pitched in Breaking Bad, but not brought to termination or brought to their full fruition. Like what happened in Chile, what happened with Madrigal, how did the chicken Madrigal connection ever develop? All that stuff.
That's fascinating. See, this is why I podcast with you, Mike, because you bring such a great perspective.
Oh, thanks, Jamie.
I'm serious.
That's why I podcast with you, because you keep throwing me compliments. All right, let's go through the episode. We start out at the Oasis Motor Court sign. Now, Jamie, I thought the Oasis Motor Court might have had a previous presence on Breaking Bad, so I Googled it and looked it up, looked left and right, couldn't find anything about it. I actually thought it might have been the hotel that Walt drove to with the meth when he was making the drop-off of the very first sale to Gus.
Right.
And he ran over, or he threw the tire out, and it hit the phone. It was that old abandoned hotel. Kind of looked like a little bit like the drawing on this billboard. But I don't think it is, because it doesn't appear in any of the wikis. It wasn't discussed in those terms on the Insider podcast. It just seems to be a groovy 50s, 60-ish hotel billboard from back in the day.
Okay.
But Mike's setting up a trap. Or a guy in a black outfit setting up a trap. We find out later it's Mike. And he's trying to get the frozen gifts truck headed back south towards Mexico. We do see that the truck is headed south. And what happens is he puts up the hose with the nails in it and pulls out the spike strip just in time and flattens the tires. And it's our buddy, the truck driver, guy who we saw at the one-er, we called a one-er, we found out afterwards, had actually a cut in the middle of it, so it's a two-er.
Yes, that is correct.
But it's still pretty cool scene. The truck gets flattened, the guy gets out, looks back towards the sign and sees a blue car hidden behind the sign, and Mike, because of his rigging of the spike strip with a cable, is actually going to be behind this guy, comes up, surprises him, and bam, he's got the guy. He's out of position from where the guy thinks, ties him up, and finds the money in the truck.
That is correct. And just a little bit of trivia. The song that was playing in the truck, that crazy-sounding song, I recognized by sound because it is an original Louisiana song that got popular like way back in the, I think it was maybe the 90s, called Don't Mess With My Tutu.
You gonna sing some of it for us, Jamie?
Oh my God, Mike.
Like Jimmy sings some Rupert what Holmes for us?
If we didn't record this thing, I would happily, happily sing it for you.
All right, I'll let you off the hook.
It was in Spanish, but seriously, that's the American. The American version was first.
Yeah, what's it called?
Don't mess with my toot-toot.
And by toot-toot, they mean like your butt, like your two bumps of your butt. Don't mess with my butt.
Nope.
Yeah, they do. I heard it on the Insider podcast.
No, that's not what they mean. That's what don't... Your toot-toot is like your sweetheart.
Okay. But they interpret it, or they intended it to be... You can listen to the Insider podcast. So I'm not going to argue with you.
Okay.
That's what they said. But it's kind of a funny little, it actually reminded me of Gale and his little beep, 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 beep song when he was making dinner right before Jesse, spoiler alerted him.
Okay, so, come on, Mike.
Remember that song? He was singing along with that fast Italian.
I do remember that song, and I actually remember what they said on the Breaking Bad Insider podcast about that song, and that is that it is it's from an Italian opera, and the guy who played Gail Bettiker, and I can't think of his name right now, but the actor actually memorized that song. That was not in the script. He just found the song and memorized it so that he could do that singing in that scene.
Well, if he had that song on with the volume a little bit lower, Jamie, he may be alive today. But no, he had it full blast and he was singing full-throatedly and enthusiastically enough to not hear the phone warning him.
Yeah, that's so sad.
Or Gail.
I forgot that his loud music actually prevented him from getting warned.
He died doing something he loved, singing and cooking.
He died being really paralyzed with fright and begging for his life.
I guess he had a minute after that to see Jesse staring him down. You're right.
Yeah, it was much better what Nita went through. She was all upset, but she thought she would have another minute to be able to be upset.
All right, Jimmy, we get the credits. Now, the credits are the matchbook in the urinal. The Saul Goodman matchbook?
Yes.
Pretty bold credits video there, visual. Yeah. Getting peed on by something. And we come back. I got some more colors for you, Jamie. Blue is rampant again in this episode, although I don't know why.
Oh, well, okay. So actually, I'm glad that you brought that up, because I did notice that in one of the early scenes of the show, when Jimmy and Kim are painting in their dental office, there's some interesting color going on there.
Well, yeah, we can talk to that when we come to it.
Okay.
I've got a thought about that color, too, because that was not blue.
Uh-huh.
But Chuck is wearing a very blue tie as he gets ready in the morning. He's going to the hearing, the banking commission hearing. Mm-hmm. And, well, let's talk about this, too, Jamie, the name game. This nailed, obviously, Mike has the nails in the garden hose to flatten the truck tires. But I also think this has a double meaning to it. Now, I've read a couple things about this episode, about it really reflecting kind of the result of Pride goeth before the fall.
Mm.
So kind of getting nailed for being prideful or having vanity. And I saw this in Chuck. I see this in a lot of people, but the first person we see it in is Chuck. Chuck's being picked up by Howard, and Howard says, "You don't really have to come. I want you to be comfortable. I don't want you to be uncomfortable." And Chuck says, "Huh, I find victory laps very comforting, Howard."
Yeah.
Very full of hubris and vanity and just braggadocio, right?
Yeah, he was in unusually, annoyingly fine form, because he was feeling like very proud of himself for what he did.
So the whole idea behind Pride Goeth Before the Fall is you fall because you don't see the warning signs, because you're too prideful, you're too overconfident in yourself. And this is exactly what happens to Chuck. He finds out this mistake, and he can't believe a mistake could have been made, and he gets nailed for it. But another interesting thing, before we get even to that hearing, Jamie, is that Jimmy's watching Chuck and Howard from outside Chuck's house with the papers in his hand. Now, did you even notice that in the very first watch, they had those papers in his hand?
No, I didn't.
Isn't this like, so this must be like a day after he does this copy paste switch address trick?
Yes, I think it is.
See, I thought this was like a few days after, and not so quickly in sequence. But I think it means Jimmy's going back there to put the originals back in the files.
For sure, that's what Jimmy was doing.
So do you know why? That went over my head. Why didn't he just do it when he did it? Why?
Because he actually made copies of every document in that box. We find that out later when the confrontation happens between Chuck and Jimmy in front of Kim, that he actually made copies of everything. And what he needed to do was switch out the violated box that had the bad copies in it with the original box that didn't have anything bad in it.
So he didn't do that the night he made this all happen, and just in case Chuck might have looked through them again and seen the two differences?
Well, he couldn't, because, I mean, how would he get, you know, for Chuck to think that it was, you know, the others? I mean, like, he had to actually, like, when they went to court, I mean, or wherever they were, the reason that this whole thing was found out is that the people who were doing the license or whatever it was actually saw the wrong copies. Like, they were handed the wrong copies. So Chuck had to have the wrong copies.
Right. So I'm still confused about the sequence of stuff. Okay, Chuck's hurt. The night of the bed, the night of the switch, Chuck's hurting. He's barely conscious on his couch. Jimmy goes in, sends Ernie away, and he makes the switch. He makes the Photoshop copies and edits and makes the alterations. He goes back to Chuck's after that and puts those altered documents in the folders where he's marked their locations in the 13 or 17 spots or whatever, different 17 different documents.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck then takes those documents, probably makes copies of them, and sends them off to the people who then submit them to the court.
No, I think those boxes went with Chuck to the court.
Okay. And then three or four copies of everything get sent to the people that need to see them, including the clerk who sees the difference.
Well, it wasn't the clerk. It was the people who actually sit on the board and make the decisions.
Right, but one of them was a clerkish type woman who saw, hey, wait a minute, this address doesn't match.
Oh, okay.
But if this had happened just the night before, how did they have enough time? Was she just looking at them that morning at the time of the hearing?
Yeah, Chuck had to bring the box of documents with him.
Okay. I guess it doesn't really matter. It's just a technicality that I'm kind of caught up in. But okay. Jimmy's bringing the originals back, and in his hand, you can see a sheaf of papers. And we see Chuck and Howard arrive at the commission office or the court, wherever the commission holds the hearing. And Chuck struggles. He has to man up to get through that detector.
Right.
Like he's walking through a meat grinder or something.
Yeah.
It's the New Mexico Banking Board, wherever they hold their hearings, whatever that building is. Mesa Verde and the State of New Mexico Banking Board. Commissioner greets Chuck like he's a returning hero. Again, more the hubris and vanity of Chuck. Chuck, glad to see you. You know, you're a big shot. I'm glad to see you again. Kind of got that vibe off the commissioner.
Right.
Kevin starts to make his statement, and then the clerk steps up. Whoa, hold on a second. We got a little typo in play here. Got a little typo here we got to figure out. And they start arguing among themselves.
Right. And did you notice what Kevin said? He's like acting so proud of his company because he says, you know, we've been in business for blah, blah, blah years. And, you know, all because we have attention to detail. Did you hear that part?
Yeah. It's all propping Chuck up. And, you know, we've hired the best. We are the best. We give everybody. And, you know, this poor banker, Kevin, probably did do all the T's and I's dotted properly in his whole 46 years of existence until he runs into this little play. So it's kind of upsetting to him, to say the least. But they start confusedly arguing a little bit among themselves. And then Chuck acts like an ass to Paige. You're mistaken about the address, and you're muddying the waters, frankly. Just a dick. I mean, she's an attorney. She's the head attorney of this whole banking company.
Yes.
So you don't talk to her like that, especially when she's your client.
That's right.
So he's just reinforcing his assness, I think.
Yes, exactly.
I am too big to fall. I cannot be wrong. I'm a hubris laden lawyer, and I am not wrong, little person.
God, you sound like, you know what? Oh gosh, what was that episode of that? Oh yeah, Mr. Robot. When you were saying that dude was a misogynist, and you're like, you know, I'll tell you the ways of the world, little girl. That's what it reminds me of.
Well, it's true. It's like Ozymandias. It's like, I will not fall. I'm here forever. I'm great. But then he's so blind to what could possibly have happened that, you know, everybody makes a mistake every now and then.
That's correct.
That he's like, wow, Paige, I'm sorry. You might be right. But no, you're mistaken, and you're causing confusion by adding in your opinion. You don't talk to people.
And the fact that he just could not admit that it was possible that he could make a mistake.
Yep. Pride before the fall. Now here's his fall.
Yep.
The hearing gets delayed by 6 weeks, which Kevin freaks out about. And Jamie, even though the commissioner has this bright blue tie on, Paige is wearing blue. Everyone, blue everywhere. And then doom just hovers above as they pan out from the scene, the doom of the fluorescent lights spraying down their electromagnetic pain on Chuck.
Yes.
Pretty awesome scene. Pretty great photography showing just like, oh, he's just saturated in this electromagnetism now.
That's correct.
Coming to play later in this episode, by the way.
Wait, how's that? Oh, yes.
So Chuck races home, determined that Jimmy was somehow involved, I think. It was, now, wasn't this too easily discovered, Jamie? This Chuck figures this out, like, toot sweet, no problem, this is it.
Toot toot, you mean?
Whatever. Too easy, too simple, too simplified.
No, not at all. And the reason why is because Chuck is going to blame Jimmy for everything, even if there's not really, even if it's not really him. Because Chuck doesn't trust Jimmy. Like, and he shouldn't, but he doesn't, you know? And even though he comes off like a total ass in this thing, there's a way to understand that. I mean, you know, I don't have sympathy for him, and it was really, this season has been such a psychological journey, because I never imagined that I could hate and sympathize with somebody, and particularly a television character, you know, in that way. I mean, like in reality, in real life, yes. You know, there are lots of, you know, 3D situations where you can, you know, really dislike someone but feel real sympathy for what their plight is. But in this moment, when I saw what was going on with Chuck, I sympathized with him greatly. But I cannot stand him. He's an asshole.
Yeah. Even Howard tries to comfort him. He says, we take our licks and we move on. Come on, it wasn't you. We all made this mistake. It was the firm. Anyone in this firm could have seen those addresses.
But Chuck is unwilling to accept that he could have made a mistake, which is where you start getting into that real serious, like, wow, dude, really? Like, kind of moment. Like, how could you have that much ego?
We got a scene next, Jamie, where Mike is watching Team Hector through the binoculars. And we see, here's where we see Hector's Chekhov's coughing fit or whatever. He's just spazzed out so stressfully that he's going to pop an artery or whatever, go into his aneurysm.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. He has a stroke later. And when we saw him take that medication, I was like, dude, that's how he ended up having his stroke that made him an invalid, is like he flipped out angry at somebody and collapsed.
Well, we think that's probably how he becomes an invalid.
Yeah.
And I think you said earlier that Mike's just happy seeing Hector suffer. I think Mike's happy because he sees a potential weakness. The guy's a stressed out maniac. I can push him into this medical situation with more stress. I think Mike sees a chink in the armor.
Maybe. I don't know, because Mike is freaking clever. I wouldn't put anything past him.
All right, Jamie. Well, Mike has some hubris, too. Mike now goes to a bar, buys a drink, and then buys the whole dive bar round of drinks.
That's correct. And, you know, when he did that, I was like, dude, you're using a $100 bill from the money you stole to do this. It's not smart.
Mike's breaking bad here. I think a few people break bad in this episode, or at least continue to break bad. He feels a big rush of ego when he turns around, everybody claps, he holds his arms up like, yes, thank you, I accept your praise. and it's all in vanity, right? He toasts the bar, he's happy, he's adulterated by this attention. Or adulation he feels from this, adulterated is not the right word, but he feels adulation from it. And later on he goes and he flirts at the restaurant with the woman waitress that we know from other episodes, but he's flirting with her. He's bold and he's happy. He's just like exalted in this ego.
Yeah, I don't know about that. He was normal and she was the one who flirted. Like Fran was the one who was like, you can sweep my driveway anytime you like.
Yeah, but she walks away to do her rest of her rounds, and he calls her back. Hey, does it ever snow here? He gets her. He's not done flirting with her when she's ready to leave and go back to work.
Oh, no, wait. No, I don't remember that happening in that order. I remember her flirting with him and then leaving to go to another table, and then he smiled, and then the scene was over.
No.
So I'm not sure.
You can watch it again. I paid attention because I was looking for, because these are things Mike, these are not natural things in Mike. He's not vain, and he is not full of hubris. He's careful, and he's smart. These are two very unlike Mike things, buying those rounds and using money from the crime, and then this scene with the woman. I don't even think that scene with the woman is here yet, right? It's a little later in the episode. Or maybe it is here.
Yeah, it's when he's in the diner.
Yeah, it's a little later.
Oh, are you still in the bar?
Yeah, the bar's a quick little scene. He has a drink. He buys a round. Everyone gives him a big cheer, and he holds his arms up. Yes, thank you. I'm great. Next, we go to Jimmy and Kim moving the dentist chairs, and a pretty cool little montage of office cleaning and painting. And so here's where you can drop your color theory, Jamie.
Okay. All right. So. All right. So when I was all into my Breaking Bad thing, part of my color theory is that brown is lies. It represents lies. And they were wearing red, which, like, those shirts that they had on were, like, super, super, super dark, like, maroonish color, like red, super dark red mixed with brown. That's what it looked like to me. And so for me, that means danger and lies. And Kim was wearing gray slacks, and gray is neutral. And Jimmy was wearing blue jeans, and blue is protection. So I think that when you put it together, you know, like, Kim is neutral because she's stuck in the middle. She's angry with Jimmy for what happens in this episode, but she's also, she can't stand Chuck. So she's, like, in the middle. And then Jimmy, you know, and they're both participating in this deep, dark, serious lie. Like, that's awful what they did, even though Chuck kind of deserved it. You know, what they did is just, it's wrong from an objective standpoint. And Jimmy got protected by Kim. You know, he's got on that blue, and that's exactly what she did. She protected him. So I'm starting to think maybe my color theory might be still valid.
Can I give you my color theory on the dentist's office?
All right.
Okay, I see. First of all, the montage was cool. The painting and cleaning, it was really cool. Mm-hmm. But I saw the color they were painting was kind of a brownish red, reddish brown.
That's right.
Which Gilligan has mentioned in the Insider cast represents criminality.
Well, he said red does. Red.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'm giving you my theory. Brownish red. I'm calling it a shade of red. And interestingly, Jimmy had a big old smear of it on his back of his shoulder, like he's starting to get painted red. Like he bumped into the wall and got some of the brownish red paint on his shoulder.
Well, that is definitely not an accident, you know. But I'll tell you something. I think that the fact that they're painting the walls in there, and what color were the walls originally? They were yellow. Yellow means you either to be feared, you're in fear, or you should be feared, or you should be in fear. And I think that they're painting the danger and the lies over the fact that they should both be afraid, very afraid. And that's my idea for the paint and the colors.
Okay, well, that's good. Can I finish my theory now?
I'm sorry. I thought you were done.
No, I got a lot more. So yellow, yeah, that's actually very clever. That, and maybe even a different take on that is they painted their yellow over with criminality. Like, this is not an up and up on the up and up law firm. It's going to be tainted with, like, things below the tact, you know, not being as tactful as they should. Well, but anyway, the color missing in that office was blue. There wasn't blue on the walls anywhere.
There wasn't.
And there also was a very colorful rainbow. I don't know if that was left over from the dentist's office or if they put that in there, but that's the one thing Kim did not want Jimmy to be colorful. And here's a freaking rainbow painted across the center right where the receptionist is going to greet people.
Wow.
That had to be left over, I think, from the dentist, because I cannot see them putting that in that office.
Yeah, no. That had to be, that was part of the dentist's office.
So while they're there, Kim gets a call from Paige. She's going to get Mesa Verde back. Jimmy acts surprised. Ernie calls another few minutes later and has tells Kim to come pick up the related documents to the case. Now, Jamie, this is really meticulous planning by the writers, because Chuck needed a moment to get to talk to Kim, and she could have easily refused almost anything except, hey, come over and get these documents that you need now that you're taking over the case. It's a fail-proof way to get her over there to talk to Chuck.
That's right.
Perfect planning by the writers. Now, Chuck didn't expect Jimmy to come along with her, but that was a perfect reason for her to go over at that minute to Chuck's.
That's right. Come right now.
So they do go over there, and the locks are changed. Chuck dismisses Ernie and has a little talk with Kim and Jimmy and tells the theory of the altered documents. He remembers being barely conscious. He remembers Ernesto being sent away. He says Jimmy's always been a criminal, even in high school. He's not pulling any punches here. He's telling this all to Kim. And tries to blow Jimmy out of the water with it. As Jimmy refutes Chuck, it dawns on Kim that Chuck is telling the truth. And the later arm punches confirm this.
That's correct.
So even though Chuck has no evidence, she realizes he's right. Even though she doesn't like him for the way he's saying it to him, she realizes that he's telling the truth.
Yep.
Chuck again says, I did not make a mistake. You know, more of that vanity, but... Kim says he idolizes you and you just judge him. You simply just judge him and you never wanted him to succeed.
I actually really loved what she said. I thought it was so great because it was really revealing. I think it told us a little bit more, just a little bit more about history among those three. I really liked it. I liked what she said because I think... that we all know people like that, who, when we're not in a position of strength, they don't see the best in us. They don't want to give us a chance, and they will stomp on us if they have the opportunity.
So you're talking about Chuck stomping it on Jimmy, or Kim not stomping on Jimmy when she could have?
No, I'm talking about Chuck. You know, making, and I loved it that she said, he's like this because of you. You know, I just thought it was so great. I thought it was so really passionately on Jimmy's side. And, you know, even though he did not deserve it, and even though he really did that, like he really did what Chuck thought he did, it was really nice to see somebody stand up to Chuck for Jimmy. And I kept thinking to myself, you know, if Kim still worked at the firm, she would have been as quiet as a mouse. She would never have said a word. But because she quit and she doesn't owe anything to Chuck anymore, she was able to stand up and say, you know, what she had to say in order to help the man she loves.
Well, and we almost had to feel, or I should speak for myself, I had to feel a little sorry for Chuck here, too. Even though I do not like the guy, I've told you before, I could not wait to see him, like, end his run here on this show, that he's so vain that he doesn't even see this in himself. I didn't make a mistake. I'm not being mean to Jimmy. Jimmy's just doing this all to himself. He doesn't realize what he's not giving Jimmy, the love he's not giving him, the support he could be giving him. He's just too vain to know this about his brother.
Well, okay, so I don't see it exactly as vanity in that sense. What I saw, and the reason why I felt sorry for Chuck, is because I understand that feeling, the feeling that he has, because here's the thing. You got to grow up in the right kind of circumstances to really get that. There are people who, when you're a powerless person, you're a child or a teenager, trapped by the circumstances of your life and your age, there are people who will use the fact that you can't fight back to hold you down. And I could see this with, or like, you know, when you're in a position like Chuck is, you know, if we go back to the episode Rebecca, where Chuck just could not be heard, like he, sounds messed up.
Yeah, your level's too high.
My level's too high?
Just kidding. You have your speaker too close to your microphone. Feedback.
I don't have my speaker. You did something.
I'm sitting here listening to you.
I didn't touch anything.
Okay, well, what can I do? I'm 3,000 miles from you.
I don't know, but I heard you knock something, and then the sound.
Ooh, I put a hex on you.
Right. Anyway, okay, so when you're in a position like Chuck is, where you're the one that always does right, like Chuck is the rock star. He had to have been a really, really good student in school. He's always bailing Jimmy out, so he's not the one who got in trouble. Chuck is Mr. Walk the Line, right? And in order to be a person who really is convinced that you couldn't do something wrong, you've got to be obsessed with getting everything right, right? So that's Chuck. He's in that situation right now. And once again, he thinks that he's got Jimmy. He thinks he's got him. You know, like, I'm going to show the world for once and for all, this is not the awesome dude you think he is. He's an asshole. He's a criminal. He's somebody who will do anything to get what he wants.
He's a chimp with a machine gun.
Right? And the thing is, Chuck is right. But nobody believes him. So that's got to be a horrible moment.
Yeah, it's weird that he's right. But, I mean, Chuck's ultimate goal is to keep Jimmy from a livelihood. He's pretty freaking evil. Even though I just said I felt sorry for him, he wants Jimmy to never have become a lawyer and to just be a mail clerk somewhere quiet and, you know, out of everyone's line of sight, so he's not a danger to anyone. But that's not a life. That's Gene's life at Cinnabon. Chuck wants Jimmy neutralized and not fulfilled. That's horrible.
Well, you know what? I think if you ask Chuck that question, Chuck would say, I love my brother. I don't want for my brother to be in trouble. But this thing that I have, that is everything to me. My career, the law, what I think about the law, and basically what defines Chuck. Jimmy is like, you know, bleeping all over it.
Yeah. You know? Jimmy's making fun of Chuck's true love. Chuck's true love is the law, and Jimmy's like, I don't know what you'd even call it. You know, he's playing with it, and Chuck does not like that.
No, and he shouldn't. And, you know, and I mean, if you think about it from his perspective, you know, like, again, like, sort of, you know, embellishing the history that we know about Chuck, right? He's probably thinking this was my one haven. You know, I don't think it's an accident that Chuck studied law. I think that living with Jimmy, you know, growing up with Jimmy, probably put him in mind of trying to, or obsessed with maybe trying to make sure that everything is right and that the rules are followed and that there are consequences for not following the rules. I think that was a big, big part of who Chuck became. And so this has got to be his one thing, his haven, his place where he can feel like the world is turned right side up. And, you know, here comes Jimmy.
Let's also not forget, though, that Chuck's mentally imbalanced. He's not right. He's got a bad take on things.
And I wonder, you know, I want to go back to, you know, my original theory about that, which is that maybe Jimmy drove him out of his freaking mind.
I'm not going to go and buy that. I think Chuck's... I don't know. They're making a point about vanity in this episode, and Chuck is just rife with it.
He's
so overconfident, he doesn't see his shortcomings, and this is one of his shortcomings, not loving his brother, not supporting his brother. He got him out of trouble once, but other than that, he's trying to neutralize him, and that is not a good thing to do with somebody you really care about.
Well, no, but, I mean, he's trying to neutralize him because Jimmy is a... You know, Jimmy. Jimmy is out of control.
Yeah, I get it. He's trying to tramp on Chuck's sacred ground of lawyerhood, but it's...
Well, I mean, it's not just that. I mean, the dude is... He doesn't care who gets run over when he starts running. When he starts his steamroller, he doesn't care who's under it.
No one cares if Kim's under it.
Only a little. Only when he thinks of it. If he's not thinking of it, he doesn't care.
He cared if Francesca was under it. No, I know. You're right. He's reckless. He's definitely reckless.
Yeah.
All right. Now, so they load the documents into Jimmy's crappy car, the documents they retrieve from Chuck. Why are they driving around in Jimmy's crapmobile, Jamie? Kim has got to have a nicer car than that.
Yeah, I think she has a Honda Civic.
Why are they using his car?
Because he's the dude.
Because it's funnier? It's very funny to watch that car drive.
No, I think it's because he's the dude.
So Kim punches him in the arm, just drive, we're done with this. And I, like I said, the fact that she stands up for Jimmy bodes doom, I think, for her.
Yeah, I agree.
Jimmy tears around. They do a lot of tearing around corners without looking for traffic in this show. Tears around corner with smoke belching out the exhaust pipe. The guts probably had that car floored for that shit box to go that fast.
God.
All right, we cut to a scene. It's at a school now, Jamie. They're playing some tetherball. Did you have tetherball when you were a kid?
Uh-huh.
Tetherball, kids are playing. Jimmy's right back at it. This is right on the heels of this pretty dramatic scene with Chuck. I don't know if it's the same day or next day, but it's not 3 weeks later. He's right back at it. His movie producing efforts are back and forth with Team New Mexico.
Right.
Now, Sepinwall pointed out, Jamie, that they crossed the street like the Beatles in Abbey Road.
They did.
And I got to admit, I mean, I thought this too without the help of Sepinwall before I read it on Sepinwall, that that looks like frickin' Abbey Road.
Yeah, it really, really did. And I've got to say, I hope that they own up to it. I hope that's really what they wanted to do because it was so George Harrison in the front and kind of. Thing. Who was in the front? Was it Paul or was it George?
I think Paul's last in his bare feet out of step. That's why people were saying he was dead.
Yeah. No, I think it's John Lennon in the front. I can't remember. Oh, gosh. Now you got me thinking.
Google it, Trouthammer.
Oh, would you? Dude.
Jamie, there's a new member on Team New Mexico. It's a makeup girl.
Yeah.
We see her act pretty funny in this, but they get caught right away. They get caught by some school admins come storming out of the building with the, right after the rhubarb. Rhubarb. Warning. Rhubarb. So, Jimmy, we're kind of kidding around here, but what do you think is the significance of them almost getting caught a lot? Like they almost got caught with the Fifi bomber.
Okay, wait. Hold on. I'll tell you. Hold your question. I'll tell you who the guys are. Okay, so it's John Lennon in front. Then it's George. Then it's Ringo Starr. Then it's Paul, actually, barefoot. And then George. George brings up the rear. So I guess we could say that Jimmy is John Lennon.
Okay. That's all. And thank you for listening, everybody. Come back next week for 210. Jimmy is John Lennon. No, they get a rhubarb warning. Rhubarb bogeys on the front. What's the significance, Jamie, of them almost getting caught in their capers like this with the Fifi bomber, with the flag here?
Oh, well, I mean, come on. That's like, you get capers are much more fun when you almost get caught.
Okay. It's dramatically, it's very funny. It's like, it's conflict turning to pretty damn funny situations both times.
Yeah, I mean, that's why they're doing it, for the humor.
It's not anything more serious on their path to greater trouble?
Probably not.
Just a little comedic conflict to overcome?
Yeah.
Well, Jimmy talks his way into the Pina Colada guy, Rupert Holmes. It's a documentary on Rupert Holmes.
Right.
And they don't seem to know who he is, so Jimmy sings a little bit of it. And the makeup girl sways to it as he's singing. And then one of the admins even blushes as Jimmy points at her when he says, making love at midnight.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about? She blushes. She kind of smiles. And the makeup girl offers, isn't he British? Right. You wouldn't have gone to school here. Thanks a lot, Team New Mexico, new member, makeup girl. And the admins go back in to check up on the story. But they've actually been pretty charmed by Jimmy. They agree to help keep the kids quiet if they can manage to.
Right.
He's a great, such a great charm. Oh, what would you even call him? A charmer? He's worse than a charmer. He's like a snake charmer. And Jimmy does this very dramatic flag pose. That's a pretty effective video. If he's going to stitch these together, he's going to have a cool little video.
Well, he's never had trouble putting together an awesome commercial.
Now, Jamie, he's getting awful damn close to Saul, because as we know, Saul is very patriotic. He's got the Statue of Liberty on the roof. He's got the Constitution on the walls. That's Saul coming. He's being born in front of us here.
I think you're right.
Getting closer and closer.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now let's go to Mike and Fran and see if they're really flirting, Jamie. Mike buys his paper at his favorite diner, and Fran makes him the special breakfast exception. If Mike asks if it's still breakfast still being served. It is if you want it, baby.
Right.
And she goes to walk away. I swear to God, I watched this happen. She starts to walk away to put the order in, and Mike stops her and asks about snow. He makes small talk. He's not done talking with her when she's ready to go back to work. And then she offers the show. You can shovel my driveway up in wherever I live. It's very clearly flirting.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And I think it's Mike being pumped up from this caper with, he knows now that he's got the money, he's got the truck disabled, he's got, not Tuco, he's got Tio, Hector, like looking like he has a weak spot. He's riding high on some vanity, I think, here.
I don't know. I think he was in the bar. I don't know about in the diner, but I will tell you that I think that he was really happy and feeling awesome. So I don't know about the pride part in the diner, but I know he was very happy. Like,
that's the best time to pick up a girl, man. Like, you just win. We won the championship. Or I just got the big promotion. I'm successful. I'm flush with pride.
Well, then I could see it from that angle because he was confident and happy. You know, I just didn't think of it as being like hubris type stuff.
My question to you, Jamie from Georgia, is mm-hmm. Fran going to get sucked into this vortex somehow?
I don't know about that.
Because we see her in the future, right? This is the Fran that says, hey, Mike, in front of Lydia when he tries to be...
That's correct.
Yeah, so she's alive in the future. But I don't know. I mean, maybe she's too much of a ancillary character to be sucked into this vortex of trouble that Mike seems to be heading into.
Yeah, probably, especially since we know that she has a future. So,
Mike gets a call from Nacho, and they have a meeting. He leaves the restaurant. They meet in that vertical building with the pillars and columns. I don't know what it is still. I still can't figure it out if it's a chicken coop or some fantastic new art museum or some abandoned building that's been empty for 10 years. Nacho explains the hit. He knows that it was Mike because the guy's alive and nobody else would have let that guy live. And Mike says the driver will not recognize him. And this makes Nacho somewhat amazed that how Mike could have done this on his own. You did this on your own? And Mike says, well, you guys aren't as smart as you think you are.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a little bit more vanity here. I think I'm smarter than you guys. I'm proving it.
Mm-hmm.
But Mike shows a little bit of crack in his armor here. Why wasn't this in the paper? And Nacho says, well, why do you even care? You were out of this. Hector had forgotten you or has forgotten you. And Mike says, I have not forgotten him.
Uh-huh.
So, Jamie, when Nacho now realizes Mike wants to have Hector arrested and caught, which would probably mean ruin for him.
Uh-huh.
They move this, they're showing them standing up in this vertical pillared room or building. They move the camera to an angle where Mike's higher up than Nacho on the angle of the shot.
Uh-huh.
So it's kind of, I think it's meant to show that they're not on an equal level.
Probably.
It has to have some meaning because it was a very odd looking shot.
Well, I will say this, Mike had the better of him, you know, and Mike usually has the better of people. And this was really interesting and very kind of, I don't know, it was like a positioning thing. You're right. Posturing, you know, because, you know, Mike told, Nacho, get your hand out of your pocket, you know?
He also didn't try to cover anything up. It's like, here, Nacho, here's the whole truth. You can have it. I don't care.
That's right.
I'm not worried that you know the truth.
Yeah.
So, Jamie, I think, you know, Mike can't be a half criminal any more than Jimmy can be a half Saul. They both have to be either all in or all out. They have to fully break into criminal mode or give it up completely. And we know that's not going to happen. So Mike's going through a process just like Jimmy's going through a process.
Hmm.
He's still pulling off half measures, which he would disdain in season 4 of Breaking Bad, or whenever he, season 3, whatever, whenever he gave that lesson to Walt.
Uh-huh.
You gotta listen to Walt or to Jesse.
Walt. I'm sorry?
When Mike gave the half measures, full measures lesson.
No, that was, he told the story to Walt, and it was about murdering Jesse. Like, Jesse was out of control because of the death of, what's his name? His friend. Oh, gosh, I can't think of his name. Combo. Because of the death of Combo, Jesse was just out of control because he just discovered from Andrea that that Andrea's little brother was the one who killed Combo, and it was because the gang told him to.
Right, the gang was using children.
Right, and those were Gus's guys. And so Jesse was planning to kill those dudes. And, like, that was after the meeting out at the farm where, like, Jesse didn't want to shake hands and he didn't want to make peace and everything. And Walt went out there, and that was when Walt was sitting at the right hand of Gus. And that was the first time you'd ever seen anybody sitting at Gus's right hand or even on the right side of him. And Walt had gone out there to save Jesse's life. Like, he was trying to keep them from killing him. And then Mike gave that speech about no half measures. And then that night was the night that it all went down.
You just reminded me of a scene that had a sister mirror image in Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. In that very scene you just described, Gus stands up to Jesse and says, "You have one friend in this room, and it's this man," and he pointed to Walt.
Uh-huh.
And then we had that scene in Better Call Saul when Cliff said, "You have one friend in this room, and it's me," to Jimmy.
Oh, wow.
With the three attorneys from Davis and Maine. Or not Davis and Maine. Yeah, and Maine. Anyway, I don't know why I thought of that, but I thought of that.
That is awesome, Mike.
But, so, Jamie, there were some problems with Mike's caper because it wasn't in the papers. there was a good Samaritan involved. Now, Jamie, yeah. I asked you once before how dark this whole thing can get. And I think we're starting to see those shadows, Jamie. And I think it's very dark.
I agree.
Dark, like good Samaritans crossing the paths with cartel and like Gene in the garbage alley and they're giving us these clues, like maybe Kim's demise, Kim's career going dark, or her life ending. And just night. I mean, there's a lot of night and dark around Chuck and his house and all this. But Nacho answers him why it wasn't in the papers. We cleaned it up. Hector shot the guy in the face. Good Samaritan came along, helped untie the driver, called us. The driver called us. We came out there, and Hector shot him in the face.
Yeah. Yeah. Man, that was crazy. And I loved Michael Mando, the guy who plays Nacho. He's just so good. Like, I love this dude's acting. I will watch him. Like, when he's not in this series, I'm going to watch this guy because he's so good. Like, what he said was really interesting, and the way he characterized it was just so great because, you know, when he was talking about the Good Samaritan, he said something like, the guy came and was like, oh no, or something like that. Do you remember what he said? It was some sort of exclamation that the Good Samaritan made.
I don't remember the words he used, no.
So it was something like that, oh no. And the way that Michael Mando delivered that line, it would just was so vivid, right? It made me think of the driver on the ground and, you know, and the Good Samaritan trying to save him. And then when he delivered the line, and said Hector shot him in the face. He said it so dispassionately, as though he were saying Hector stopped at a stop sign. You know, it gave so much, I don't know, like...
Yeah, he was just delivering a fact. There was no emotion, like, you know, regretfully, Hector had to shoot him. Not sad or greedy or happy or, you know, gloating. He was just factful about it.
It was. And the way that he spoke, it just gave so many different shades of emotion to that scene. I don't know how you do something like that. Like, he's got to be really extremely talented. Because just delivering those lines the way that he did, I don't know, it was like weaving through the emotion that was in the scene. I don't know, it was amazing. I loved it.
Michael Mando's a very cool guy. If you ever hear him get interviewed, he's so sweet, he's so nice and kind sounding. He's very unlike Nacho. And he's very intelligent too. He's very, very intelligent sounding. I heard an interview with Ernesto, and he doesn't sound like Rhodes Scholarish, but Nacho Michael Mando does sound super smart and super nice when you hear him ever just out of character in real life.
Well, I told you before he started acting, he tried to get a scholarship in like some crazy thing like international relations or something like that. Like, he's really intelligent, dude.
He sounds it for sure.
Yeah.
So, Jamie, I think Mike is starting to show his... There's a basic goodness about Mike. Even though he's got a little vanity coming through on this episode, he's a good dude. He wants the things that are right to happen, almost the public good. And I think he wants to get Hector out of the game for the public good and not so much for personal gain. Like, he wants to protect Kaylee and his daughter-in-law, and He wants to maybe get the money for his own use a little bit, but he really wants to get Hector for the public, so he's not roaming around the public, just taking advantage of people and shooting freaking people in the face.
Okay, so but why then does the pride figure in there? Because if that's why he wants to do it, then he's altruistic. He's not proud.
Well, I think he's going through a process. I think he's changing. From the cop, he was a cop, then he had to do some stuff because of his son's murder. Now he has to do some stuff because of the thing with Tuco. He's like going through this catharsis of some sort. But well, for the moment, he's almost like somebody would call him a Batman. Like, bad things happened to him and he turned it into something that would do good for the public. Get this freaking cartel criminal off the face of the earth. It wasn't for personal gain. I mean, he could have just killed the driver and taken the money and escaped.
Well, yeah, he's not a killer yet. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It's interesting. He's going through some sort of metamorphosis, you know. But I think what's interesting is that he is being pulled into this. Well, I guess, you know what? You can't really say that because... This is a choice that Mike made. You know, he was fine. And even Nacho said, Hector's forgotten about you. Mike should know it because he's been watching them for so long. They're not after him. So it's not like he's being pulled into a life of criminality. He is seeking it. And I don't know why he's seeking it.
Well, I think and by the way, that's a much better word, metamorphosis. Catharsis, I guess, is a lot more healing than the way I intended. I meant to use the word you appropriately used, metamorphosis. He's changing. But I think he realizes the cost of his hubris here. He's effectively nailed now. He let the guy live, and then this poor Samaritan comes along and pays a price that... That guy should have never had to pay that. And Mike realizes, Mike has a realization here, like, oh, holy shit. He sits in his car and thinks, and we see him thinking those thoughts.
Right. And that was amazing. And I thought that the, hold on a second, the director who was Peter Gould, I think Peter Gould wrote and directed this episode, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, he did. Peter Gould was amazing because that shot was so amazing. Like, you know how you mentioned during the season how skillfully they use light and shadow in this series. Well, this was one of those moments. Actually, there were a bunch of moments like that, particularly from Mike, this episode, because if you looked at him, like, in the bright, bright sunlight when he was, like, doing the stuff to that driver and stealing the money, he looked very strong, and he looked really young. And
the answer is correct.
I'm so sorry. It's Windows 10. I'm telling you, dude. It's just telling me my Outlook settings are out of, like, something.
Your Outlook is very bright. Better than Mike's.
Right. Okay, so then later in the diner, when he's talking with Fran and flirting, he looks peaceful and happy. And then in his car, he looks so freaking old and sad. It was amazing that the same actor could look like that.
Well, some people were saying that the bars from the reflection of the light from the vertical posts in that building made him look like he was in jail of some sort. But I think that's a little too heavy-handed. I don't think that was the intention of the writers or Peter Gould, if he was the only writer or director. I think it was just Mike's kind of reflecting, right? And he's kind of caught up in his own little situation now. He tried to do what was right, and he thought he could get away with it, but he overestimated his skill here. He left one open end that came back and nailed him to that name game again. But he got kind of caught by his own not realizing that he had left this thing open ended.
Well, that could be a really artful explanation for the bars, you know, that made it seem like jail. Because really, honestly, now he's trapped.
He's trapped into his future. Yeah, he's not really trapped into a jail. But yeah, he's trapped by his actions into what he's got less options now.
That's correct.
All right, we see Jimmy brushing his teeth, and he asks Kim about her day. It's the evening of this day, I guess, some small talk. And then as Jimmy lays his head down to sleep, she quietly warns him that Chuck is super smart, and if you come up against him, you need to cross your T's and dot your I's. Essentially, get your ass back out there and bulletproof that crime, baby. You're not done. Your day's not over. You got to get back out there and finish this crime. I think Kim is Breaking Bad, Jamie. The Kim of old would not make the suggestion.
I don't know. I think we didn't know Kim very well when we first met her. I think that Jimmy could be having a bad effect on her. But I guess it remains to be seen. We don't know, you know, what kind of person she was. And so I don't know, but I will say that I'm really surprised by Kim's choices. I thought she was much more straight and narrow than she's turning out to be. And who knows, maybe, you know, she's going to tell Jimmy he's poison or something when, you know, when the whole thing goes down, when things finally hit the fan, because I think they have to.
But don't you think things have already hit the fan? She knows he altered legal documents. She wouldn't have put up with that 5 episodes ago. She's so enraptured by the chance of this future that she could grasp the Mesa Verde again and have it back in her control. That seduces her. She changes. She's going through a change. I think she's, I don't know, maybe Breaking Bad isn't the right way to describe it, but
okay. So I don't know if she's more enthralled with the fact that she has back Mesa Verde, or if it's the fact that she has Jimmy.
Interesting. I never even thought of that. That she's just happy that she has Jimmy.
And Jimmy is that dude, you know. And you know, we all know charmers. We all know people who are larger than life, whose personalities fill the room, you know, people who could influence you into doing something you wouldn't otherwise do because they're so much fun. And the risks that they take are exciting. And maybe she's seduced by that.
Maybe, but I'm not done with my Breaking Bad analogies, Jamie.
Okay, Mike.
Jimmy sees Ernesto at the printer, and he watches them, and then when he leaves, goes in and bribes this printer guy, Lance, to forget his face. Ironically, Jamie, the label on Lance's name badge is crooked. Got a guy works at a frickin' print shop, and his name badge is crooked.
That sounds about right. Lance doesn't look like he cares about too much.
I think Lance is mini Breaking Bad. He pays Lance some money to forget his name, his face. Asks him about the video camera, pays him a little bit more. Lance says, well, that's a lot. Oh, that's expensive and time-consuming to change those tapes. He sees his advantage and steps in, man. Steps into that swing. Good old Lance. And Jimmy even says, you will go far, my young friend.
Yeah, that's right. Jimmy is, like, there is no place he won't go. It's just like, yeah, you're immoral. You're trying to scam me for money. Ah, I got to give it to you.
You're Breaking Bad.
Good move, dude.
Ironically, Lance's colors, Jamie, are red, white, and blue.
Ah.
And his shirt's striped with red, white, and blue. The very patriotic series of colors. All right, so Jimmy's right. Chuck arrives. The printer guy, Lance, plays dumb and changes his story. And with Jimmy literally stepping into the actual shadows of the building across the street, he watches Chuck succumb to this electricity fear and trip and fall or slip and fall. And Jimmy can't help him. He just pleads for them to call 911.
Yeah.
Kind of helplessly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this means, I think, Jamie, that Chuck's... Well, I don't know what's going to happen to Chuck, but I don't think Lance is going to erase those tapes now because he's going to have ambulances and police show up and he's not going to have time. They're going to say, hey, what happened here? You know, and if there's a tape system, a video system, they're going to want to see that tape.
Well, I mean, no, it's not a crime. Like Chuck didn't fall and there's a mystery about what happened to Chuck. Like, everybody was in there. There were witnesses. People saw, you know, what happened. You know, I don't think there's any reason for anybody to want to see the tapes except for Chuck.
Maybe. Ernie's there, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if they ask the police? Do you think the police would even ask, why are you guys here? They'll get a statement. At the very least, they'll get a statement from Ernie. Well, okay, what's your name, sir? What are you doing here?
Right, well, they call the police, but I don't see any reason to call the police. You don't call the police when you fall and hit your head. You call an ambulance.
If somebody falls and hits their head at a printer shop, the police don't show up, just the EMTs?
Not in Georgia. Yeah, like, I mean, the ambulance shows up. There's no crime.
Oh, there's a crime. yeah, okay, well, maybe not. Maybe there is no repercussions and it just is a tragedy for Chuck. What do you think's going to happen? What do you think Chuck's results of his fall are?
I think he comes back quieter and meeker. I think he feels defeated right now because Jimmy always wins.
Okay. Now, there's theory out there about this, too. What if Chuck doesn't survive this and Jimmy doesn't call 911 and has to live with the fact that Chuck didn't survive it and he didn't call 911?
Yeah, now I thought about that for a moment.
Now, the other person that knows Jimmy's there is Kim.
Mm-hmm.
What did you do and what did you see? Does he just say, I didn't see it? Oh, too bad for Chuck. I didn't see it. I was on my way back home.
No, I here's what I think. I think that if worse comes to worse, Jimmy's going to go in there and try to use the phone if he doesn't have his phone with him. Or he's going to call 911, and they're going to reason out that Jimmy was the one who called 911 because nobody in the store did. Something will happen that either gives Jimmy away or Chuck dies. I don't know. But, no, I don't think that that's what I think. I think that, you know, either it's going to be something, you know, where Chuck hits his head and then he's, like, defeated for a while by Jimmy, you know, winning the way that Chuck sees it. Or he dies and, you know, Jimmy has to live with it, like what you said. But I don't think he wouldn't call an ambulance.
I think Chuck's dead because there's no more point to his story anymore. We've seen his penultimate episode, Red Wedding, climax here. He's shot off his wad. Whatever he needed to say to Kim, he said. Kim refuted it and stood up for Chuck, stood up for Jimmy. There's no reason for Chuck to survive. If they want a nice, clean exit for Chuck, this was it. And it's more profound to Jimmy to have seen his brother die because of his actions. Like Mike had to realize somebody died because of his actions. And maybe Kim will have a little bit of a repercussion that that was maybe partly her actions. I mean, who knows? But I think Chuck's final statement here is that this all these events led to his demise.
Hmm.
But I don't know. That's my guess.
That's a good guess. I could see it happening. Yeah, because then, you know, that would be the pall that gets cast over, you know, the happiness that Jimmy and Kim could have. And, you know, certainly that would ruin a relationship, you know. I think it's possible. I don't know that I believe that that's what's going to happen, because I don't know that we're done with that relationship yet, the two brothers. But it's interesting. It's certainly interesting.
Back at the beginning, I asked you to help me solve some of the three mysteries, and I did not even include Chuck. I should not dislike Chuck this much, but I'm not that upset that if this is the end of him, that this is how it happened. I asked you about Kim's exit, Gus's entrance, and Mike's plan. I didn't even ask you about Chuck, but they leave this profound statement about Chuck. It's kind of a cliffhanger, but Chuck's story is told, I think, here.
Hmm.
All right, Jimmy, next week is 210 Click, the end of season two. How do people reach you before we do our final podcast for the Better Call Saul season two?
I'm on Twitter. I'm at WordGirly.
And I'm on Twitter, and I'm at ScathingTweets. That's about all I got, Jimmy. Any final thoughts for Nailed?
Final thoughts for Nailed. Okay, so I thought this was a great episode. I really loved all of it. The writing was really good. It was very revealing. I love the fact that the writers are giving us background, because that doesn't happen often when you're watching a show and you really want to know what's happening. It doesn't often get revealed. And so I love that they're giving us all that information, and I'm looking forward to next week.
Me too. By the way, I started out with this telling you I learned this word deuteragonist. I think Chuck was the deuteragonist, the second most important character.
I agree with that.
But there's a lot of important characters, so it was cool. It was a good one. I really like this. They're getting better and better, and when they leave us after Click, it's probably going to be pretty hard to wait till season three.
Oh, I'm already dreading the wait. It's going to be misery.
All right, Jamie. Well, I'll see you next time on Click.
All right. Awesome, Mike.